Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of WN Movie Talk Podcast. My name is Trev, and this week I am going to be talking about An American Werewolf in London. However, unlike other episodes, I'm trying something different here. I don't know why I've done this, but I started putting this together probably about 6-7 months ago, maybe longer. I always tell the story of how when I was younger I watched American Werewolf in London for the first time. And it had such an effect on me that I started to write it, type it up one day, and it sort of grew into this memory, which became a bit of a review, included trivia. It just grew and grew, and I haven't finished it, but it's quite long, and I thought it might make an interesting episode. It's part memoir, part memory, part minute-by-minute analysis. I don't really know what I've tried to create with this. It just sort of spewed out of me. And I felt that I had to share it. So, please bear with me. I hope you enjoy this. I hope you find it as entertaining as it is educating. I hope it helps you revisit one of my favourite horror movies. Helps you understand why it's one of my favourite horror movies. Anyway, we're just going to hop straight into it. There's a lot to get through. So again, I'm reading this week, so hopefully it'll go a bit better than me mumbling my way through it. But let's have a look as I discuss 1981's horror comedy, An American Werewolf in London. I, like so many fans of American Werewolf in London, was way too young when I first watched it. I'll never forget that original late night screening. It was 1990, and I had just turned 11 years old. I've always told the story that I was 8 or 9, but when I've looked back and researched, it's clear that this was 1990, and I was 11. With my nose inches from the thick glass lens of my small bedside TV, my ear practically pressed against the plastic speaker grill as I squinted through the snowy reception of a faulty box-top antenna. It was hardly the 4K version that film aficionados like to watch these days. I had to have the volume all the way down because I promised my mum that I wouldn't watch it, but I couldn't resist. Together, we had set the video recording in the front room and my mum would let me have it if she deemed it was suitable viewing for a minor, and only if I promised to go to sleep good tonight. Of course I would. And now, at after 10 o'clock on Sunday the 22nd of July 1990, I sat in the dark of my bedroom, pretending not to watch the movie that I had wanted to watch for so long. It was part of the BBC Movie Drome series, hosted at the time by filmmaker Alex Cox, best known for directing anarchic punk films Sid and Nancy and Repo Man. Not that I'd seen either film at this point, but I knew the Repo Man trailer fairly well from the start of many hired videotapes. Movie Drome would select a different movie each week and open with an often humorous summary from Alex Cox, and many years later, on a more analytical appraisal from gentle-spoken Scotsman Mark Cousins. Even at this young, prepubescent age, I was so obsessed with films and filmmaking that I would often watch the Movie Drone's intro and then tape the films if they sounded good to me. This was midway through Series 3, in the companies of films such as Get Carter and The Terminator, which had preceded it. For the intro into An American Werewolf in London, Alex Cox stood on a hill next to a ruin of some old castle, dressed like one of Dexy's midnight runners in a dirty, aging barber jacket and a neckerchief. He tells us how American Werewolf, although considered a cult film, was seen by too many people and made too much money to qualify as such. He explains to us the differences between the vampire and the werewolf, explaining how a stake through the heart kills a vampire, whilst a werewolf can only be killed by a silver bullet or the SAS. An in-joke for the film's climax, and one which the punchline is then accentuated by the superb yet ominous howl of the wolf from the movie. A howl that's as much an agonised scream as it is a howl, chesty and terrifying. The agony of the mortal man contorted into canine form. Cox spins his head around, searching off-screen right for the source of the sound, before laughing it off and carrying on with his introduction. An American Werewolf in London, he tells us, was directed by the American John Landis, whose most notable cult feature was the Blues Brothers, but who is also very famous for his work on the Twilight Zone movie. A dark joke, obviously referring to the lengthy court case following the death of actor Vic Morrow and two children during the making of Landis's segment of that revised horror anthology. Cox tells us how the film uses every conceivable song with the word moon in it, and then to look out for Muppets genius and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels director Frank Oz appearing here as Mr. Collins from the US Embassy, to which the wolf once again replies, this time with a snarl, again borrowed from the movie itself. The presenter momentarily looks off screen to the left before he nervously clears his throat and continues. He tells us to look out for Rick Mail in The Slaughtered Lamb, alongside Brian Glover, who, he informs us, is a good actor. Another growl, screen right, and with hardly a gap between this and the last, it's circling him, closing in, as is the end of the segment. Cox picks up pace and explains how the film mixes naive comedy and apocalyptic violence with an abrupt ending. He points out that if we were to sit through the movie's credits, that we would see that the movie has been dedicated to Their Royal Highness, the Prince and Princess of Wales, on the occasion of their marriage. A few more growls on top of each other, and we fade to black as we can only assume the predator has found its prey. End of segment. A humorous, almost cynical, yet somewhat empty introduction to the film from Cox. There's no real meat to tear into, no insightful glances into the film, just a few morsels of throwaway trivia and some cheap gags. Mark Cousins, as I mentioned, would take over the Moviedrome in years to come, and his introductions became much more like short but deep film analysis, his soft Scottish accent peeling back the layers of each movie with his precise appreciation of the media. Anyway, on this night, all those many years ago, I watched the Moviedrome downstairs with my parents, then went to bed like a good boy. The minute I was in my room, I clicked the door shut, switched the light off, and was hunched against my bedside TV, just to see a little incy-wincy tiny snippet of the movie, just to find out how it starts. We see the Universal logo first, a logo that, at that age, I was more than familiar with. My most played VHS at the time was a copy of Jaws, taped from the TV, which has this very same version of the Universal Atlas preceding the opening credits. Another monster movie, Spielberg's monster movie. But then Universal is the home of the movie monster after all. Since 1912, Universal Pictures has been home to creatures such as Dracula, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, The Invisible Man, The Phantom of the Opera, and the original Werewolf of London from 1935. And let us not forget the 1941 Wolfman, starring Lon Chaney and Bela Lugosi, a movie that both American Werewolf's highly strung director John Landis and laid-back special effects artist Rick Baker both discuss as being an influence, yet also an example of what they most definitely didn't want the transformation to look like. Alongside Universal's logo during the film's silent opening is the Polygram logo, hardly a titan at this moment in time, yet an emerging production company, an offshoot of the Polygram Records, then headed by producer Peter Goober, who would later go on to release films such as Flashdance, and later still, Tim Burton's Batman. Next, a title card appears, which reads, For Jim O'Rourke. O'Rourke was a good friend of Landis's, who helped produce his first movie, Schlock. He'd recently died of lung cancer, and this is how he got the dedication, and also why Landis banned smoking from the set of American Werewolf in London. An opening shot of the moors of northern England. Only it's really the Black Mountains in southern Wales, the Brecon Beacons. The shot fades in from black, from a whipping, howling wind and some bird noises that sound far too exotic for this grey and gloomy landscape. The colour and the light in these shots seem to be reduced, dimmer, as though day is waning to the approaching night. The sound of the winds and the birds are soon replaced, though, by the easy sounds of the love ballad Blue Moon, sung in this rendition by Bobby Vinton from 1963. It's the first of three versions of Blue Moon to appear, and as Cox pointed out in his Moviedrome introduction, this is to be the first of many moon-related songs to show up in this movie. Polygram Pictures Presents is the first credit we read, lowercase lettering, all in a small white font that's not too dissimilar to Times New Roman. Polygram is soon replaced by a Lycanthrope Films limited production, again in lowercase lettering. Lycanthrope being another word for werewolf. Lycanthrope Films being a production company which to this date has only the one film credit under its belt, created by Landis for the sole purpose of producing this movie. I did warn you, Landis is not exactly subtle. And then, in full caps lock, but still the same Times New Roman, An American Werewolf in London, a play on the movie titles An American in Paris and Werewolf of London. The title's font is recognisable from other Landis films, films such as Animal House, The Blues Brothers, Trading Places. But I didn't know Landis for those films, not back then. Well, perhaps The Blues Brothers. But back then, as an 11-year-old child, watching through a near-muted TV in his bedroom on a fuzzy screen smaller than a monitor on a laptop, I knew of John Landis for something else. Flashback even further. Just for a minute, I remember the family huddled around the TV. This was back when we lived in Slough too, just west of London, England, 4 miles or so from Windsor. So if this was Slough, I must have been four or under. Our family picked up sticks days after my 5th birthday. But I remember this occasion, sort of. It's one of the few standout memories from the first 4 years of my life, second only to seeing the space shuttle piggybacking on a jumbo jet into or maybe out of Heathrow, witnessed from our back garden, which was directly under the Heathrow flight path. We were huddled around the TV, awaiting what I could only assume to be Top of the Pops. And it must have been the first prime-time broadcast of this historic pop event in the UK because the excitement was electric. We were all around the TV to watch another monster film, a short movie-come-music video spectacular, a music video that had taken the world by storm in the early 80s, Michael Jackson's Thriller, a game-changer in the industry, an influence to many generations to come, and a godsend to the newly established MTV. However, until I recently researched this, I found out that the first UK screening was at 1 a.m. on a special edition of the Channel 4 show The Tube. So maybe one of my brothers had stayed up and videotaped it, and we'd be watching it the morning or evening after. As I say, I was young, it's all a bit blurry. I don't really remember the details. However, it was an historic moment for me. A truly iconic video the world over, as was the album, which still to this day remains the best-selling album of all time. Anyway, I loved the video for Thriller so much that I purchased it on VHS from Woolworths many years later. It was the first 15 certificate video that I owned, and I was probably 8 or 9 at the time. The video was called Making Michael Jackson's Thriller, and included the full video for Thriller, directed by John Landis himself. Well, I watched that tape religiously for a while there. Before long, I got a little bored of the two-in-one Werecat and zombie musical, but the making-of documentary was 25 minutes of movie-making gold. My first taste of special features, I guess. That, and the making of Return of the Jedi, another VHS also purchased from Woolworths. Anyway, this was the first I had heard of John Landis. He was that wacky, mischievous, bearded clown, throwing Michael Jackson playfully over his head. This was also where I'd first heard of Rick Baker. He was a soft-spoken guy, painstakingly wiping sludge over a patient Michael Jackson, discussing with us the transformation sequence from this hideous, slimy mess to a startlingly realistic cat-wolf-man thing. That amazing transformation technique, they would tell us, was borrowed from and influenced by Landis's own film, An American Werewolf in London. This was where I first heard of American Werewolf in London. Jackson was a fan of the film, and Landis was his first port of call when seeking out a director for his ambitious project. This was also where I saw my very first short clip of the film. A giant vicious dog rampaging the streets of London with bloody fangs, snapping at legs as Piccadilly Circus erupted into pandemonium. Cars crashing into each other, rolling over bloody corpses. Buses crashing, People screaming, dashing here, being thrown through windows there. And then it cuts to a silent shot of Nurse Price, Jenny Agutter, asleep, as Dr. Hirsch, John Woodvine, enters the room to say, there's been reports of some type of mad dog on loose in Piccadilly Circus. Nurse Price sits up immediately and gasps, David! The rest of the movie played out in numerous scenarios in my mind from that moment on. I speculated the story, the characters, the monster, the horror. I'd seen the VHS cover on shelves at various video stores, the sweaty, stretched face contorting, razor teeth, protruding, snarled lips. This only helped to fuel my morbid fantasies. The video for Michael Jackson's Thriller was also to be the first time I heard that phrase that Landis wedged into many of his movies. As Jackson chased his scared girlfriend out of the cinema, who just happens to be his second girlfriend of the video, as they hurriedly leave the theatre, nudging past their fellow patrons, the audience continue to react to the movie on screen, yet off screen. From the film's audio, we hear a transaction between a couple of cops at the crime scene. They find a message written in blood. But what does it say? See you next Wednesday. The Landis phrase, another not always very subtle John Landis trope that pops up regularly in pretty much all of his films. In his debut movie, Schlock, in which Landis himself stars as an ape-like creature in early Rick Baker prosthetics, it's a film starring Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed and Stymie Beard. In the sketch comedy movie, Kentucky Fried Movie, which he directed and co-wrote with Airplane creators Zucker, Zucker and Abrahams, it's the movie presented in Feel Around. In The Blues Brothers, it was a movie poster on a roadside billboard where the cops give chase to Jake and Elwood only to take out the good old boys who are in hot pursuit of the brothers who are on their mission from God. The poster is a King Kong type movie. And it can also be seen in the cinema beside the road that the Nazis plough through after their ridiculous yet memorable fall from the unfinished highway. In Trading Places, it can be seen as a kind of romantic adventure poster on Jamie Lee Curtis's wall in the scene where she strips off in front of Dan Aykroyd. Yes, chaps, there was a poster on that screen too. In Coming to America, it's a poster for a Barbarella-style sci-fi B-movie. It's no trade secret that the Landis phrase actually started life as a Kubrick-Clark phrase, spoken to Frank Poole, the ill-fated astronaut in Kubrick's classic science fiction 2001 A Space Odyssey, spoken by Frank's father via video link, see you next Wednesday. A pretty dull and ordinary line that for some reason stuck with Landis, and it soon became his own. Landis even wrote a screenplay when he was in his late teens, and called it See You Next Wednesday. In American Wealth in London, it's the X-rated movie that David and a decomposing Jack will watch later on in the movie. Let's get back to the film. I'm straining to hear it through the plastic speaker of my 11-year-old self's bedroom. The credits continue to roll over the bleak, featureless valleys of North Yorkshire, or in this case, the Brecon Beacons. The rest of the credits roll, as previously, in this Times New Roman font. The actors and crew's names remaining in capitals. David Norton, the young star of the film, playing the American backpacker David Kessler. Norton had found some fame in the Dr. Pepper commercials and has been credited as having been in a Disney film called Midnight Madness the previous year. But he was still considered a relative unknown back then, with very little cinematic clout. I can honestly say that in all of the years since I first watched American Werewolf in London, I don't think I've ever seen David Norton in any other movie. And yet, check his IMDb, he has worked since, and constantly too, in both film and television. Jenny Agutter takes the second credit as Nurse Price, a nurse who likes to take her work home with her. Agutter was far more of a star by this point in her career than either of her American co-stars. She had starred in no less than 18 movies before playing Nurse Price in An American Werewolf. She was most famous for The Railway Children and for a turn in Nicholas Roeg's Walkabout. She was a friend of Landis's too, which was how she ended up in the role. In the DVD's audio commentary by the film's actors, David Norton and Griffin Dunn, the moment Jenny Agutter's name fades onto the screen, both actors gush a truly heartfelt sigh of adoration. They comment how very graceful she was when knocking back their constant advances. She was an absolute beauty back then, and posh with it too. Griffin Dunne makes up our menage a trois, another actor who I can count the times I've seen him in another movie on one hand, although I do recognise more of his film titles from his Wikipedia page than I did for Norton. And yes, you are absolutely right. The other time I saw him was in Scorsese's New York comedy After Hours. Dunne claimed that he didn't even have to do anything to earn the role of Jack. No audition. He just met Landis, they chatted, and then he was told to start work. His cheeky, self-assured demeanour obviously did the job. However, he was asked if he was claustrophobic, though, which seemed a strange question at the time. We roll through the rest of the cast. John Woodvine, a proper thespian from the Royal Shakespeare Company with a proper old school Mr. Chumley Warner BBC accent. He's cast as the inquisitive Dr. Hirsch, an ally for David within the establishment, helping to seek this conspiracy the small village of Proctor conceals. He appeared in TV and film throughout his career. Brian Glover, aka Mr. Tetley Teabags, Lila Kay and Paul Scofield share credit space with one another. They play the three main characters from The Slaughtered Lamb. Glover used to be a semi-professional wrestler called Leon Harris, the man from Paris. Must have been funny to hear his broad Yorkshire accent escaping from a supposed Frenchman. He stole the name anyway from another wrestler who didn't show up one night. He found acting without searching for it through author Barry Hines, with whom he was friends. Kitchen Sink film director Ken Loach picked up Hines' book, A Kestrel for a Knave, and on Hines' recommendation cast Glover as the PE teacher Mr. Sugden. The rest, as they say, is history. Other TV shows and films that you may have seen him in are Last of the Summer Wine, Doctor Who, Alien 3 and Bottom, in which he appeared alongside another Slaughtered Lamb patron, Rick Mayall, who's not credited here, appearing just before BBC's The Young Ones and Channel 4's The Comic Strip Presents would launch him into stardom. Lila Kay, as the pub's buxom yet homely barmaid, would have popped up occasionally through my childhood, appearing in children's BBC's Bodger and Badger as the headmistress. I won't lie to you, I used to hate that programme, so I don't really remember her in that. I guess you'd rather be remembered for her other numerous roles, including Peggotty in the 1966 BBC miniseries of Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, which featured a young Ian McKellen in the titular role. She also featured in many TV shows, including Murder, She Wrote and the Ted Danson sitcom Cheers. David Scofield, who has never once missed that dartboard in all of his years. I've seen him pop up quite a lot over the years, including in the remake of The Wolfman, starring Benicio del Toro. I always used to think he looked a bit like Rick Mayall when I was younger, but that may have just been because of their association in the scene of the film. Paul Kember, Frank Oz and Don McKillop share the next billing, which, if you think about it, is a strange order, as Oz only gets a tiny bit of a cameo, as he does in a lot of Landis's films. Oz, of course, famous for voicing the Muppets Miss Piggy and Fozzie Bear, and not forgetting Yoda, has also had a successful career as a director in later years, with films such as Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and Bowfinger under his belt. Kimber, top of the bill, plays the bumbling Sergeant McManus, the thorn in the side of Inspector Villiers, played by McKillop. He adds some additional comic relief to this otherwise subtle comedy horror. Kember had a few roles in British films prior to this, most notably in British gangster flick The Long Good Friday with Bob Hoskins and Helen Mirren. Editor Malcolm Campbell gets next credit. He would edit for Landis occasionally when George Falsey Jr. wasn't available, perhaps. He's had an active career editing comedy sequels such as Wayne's World 2, Hot Shots Part 2, Ace Ventura When Nature Calls and Scary Movie 3, which was actually my favourite of the scary movie films, the Zucker Brothers, once again taking back their favourite genre, the spoof. Legendary composer Elmer Burstyn is credited next, and legend is an understatement. In a career spanning 5 decades, Burstyn has scored over 150 movies, over 80 television shows, from westerns like The Magnificent Seven and True Grit, through masterful classics such as The Ten Commandments, To Kill a Mockingbird and The Great Escape. In the 70s and 80s, the composer leaned easily into scoring comedy movies, working on movies such as Meatballs, Stripes, Ghostbusters and Airplane, to name but a few. Composer John Frizzle, when scoring Mike Judge's Beavis and Butthead Do America, contacted Burstyn for some advice on writing music for comedy movies. Burstyn explained that the key was to play it serious, as though you'd just miss out on the joke. when Landis, as a fledgling director at 27 years of age, requested to the studio that Bernstein score his first theatrical film, National Lampoon's Animal House, the studio heads told him that Bernstein wouldn't even pick up Landis's call. But the director had an ace up his sleeve. He had been friends of Bernstein's son Peter since high school, and so the composer agreed to work with him. They would continue to work together with Trading Places, The Blues Brothers and Spies Like Us among their collaborations. Although American Werewolf is mostly remembered for the Luna-themed soundtrack, Elmer's score adds that additional layer, ominous and foreboding. Special makeup effects fades into the screen, designed and created by Rick Baker. Baker and Landis first worked together on Landis's low-budget debut comedy horror schlock, in which Landis plays the titular role as an ape-like caveman who wreaks havoc in modern California. Baker helped create the makeup, and whilst working together, Landis discussed an idea he had for a werewolf movie. Baker's appetite was truly whetted when Landis described the transformation as needing to be really painful to watch. Baker would spend the next several years developing the mechanics for this metamorphosis. When it seemed that Landis had forgotten all about their plans, Baker took on a similar job for Joe Dante, who was making The Howling. Landis was mortified to hear this news, his Wolfman script finally having been green-lit. However, Baker acknowledged the pact that the two had made and sent his apprentice to work with Dante on The Howling, and Baker hopped back on board the American Werewolf in London, creating the most memorable and excruciatingly painful werewolf transformation ever shown on film. Actually, what were they thinking using CGI all those years later for the abysmal sequel, An American Werewolf in Paris? Baker's work on American Werewolf would win him his first Academy Award for Best Makeup, an award he would pick up again another six times for movies as diverse as Harry and the Hendersons, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, Ed Wood, and the 2011 remake of the Universal classic The Wolfman. But his work in film had been prolific, with credits including Star Wars, Gremlins 2, Men in Black and David Cronenberg's Videodrome. Art director Leslie Dilley's credit appears next. Another award-winning collaborator, Dilley won the Academy Award for Star Wars and Raiders of the Lost Ark, and nominations for movies including The Abyss, The Empire Strikes Back and Alien. Dilley was born in Wales, so back on his home turf for the opening scenes of this movie. The next credit is director of photographer Robert Painter, BSC. The BSC stands for British Society of Cinematographers. Painter had a career throughout the 70s, collaborating with Michael Winner, and has collaborated on many of Landis's films since American Werewolf in London. Painter has also worked alongside Richard Lester on the Superman sequels. Executive producers Peter Goober and John Peters credit rolls in after Painter. These guys paired up to start the Goober Peters Company in 1982, bringing films such as Rain Man, Batman, Inner Space, eventually selling their company to Sony. Written and directed by John Landis is the final credit we see. Landis, known for his comedies up until this point, had been sat on this script for this movie since even before he directed his first film. As he tells it, he wrote the script in 1969, whilst working for MGM as an AD on Kelly's Heroes, which was being filmed in Yugoslavia. Whilst over in Yugoslavia, he witnessed a gypsy burial, where he says that the corpse being buried was wrapped in a canvas, which was covered in garlic and rosemary, and then buried feet first, upright in a hole. His Yugoslavian guide explained that the body was buried this way so that he couldn't get back up and cause mischief. Landis wondered what would happen if he did get up. The young AD felt that with his modern sensibilities, he would be completely ill-equipped to cope with such an event. And so the seed for the premise of the undead was planted in his mind, eventually germinating into his contemporary take on the werewolf movie. The film that my 11-year-old self anxiously watched, transfixed, a knot in my stomach, listening out for my parents approaching on the stairs. Bobby Vinton's Blue Moon finally ends, and we meet the two young American boys, David and Jack, on the UK leg of their European backpacking tour. As they arrive onto the moors and into the film, they are delivered to us among a truck full of lambs for the slaughter. Landis again makes no illusions of subtlety. Both boys are doomed to die by the end of this movie. Jack makes it clear that North England was David's choice and not his. Playful banter rolls off between them like characters from a high school teen comedy. Discussing girls, Debbie Klein in fact. David thinks is mediocre, but Jack has to disagree. There's nothing mediocre about that body. Jack looks forward to Venice and Rome, yet despite being cold and smelling of sheep shit, they are both in good spirits. We too are enjoying their company, as they joke and laugh together. That soon changes as they approach the small village of East Proctor, to Bernstein's gentle score, a piano playing a tender melody over sad and haunting and ominous strings. They reach the Slaughtered Lamb pub, as inviting as Sweeney Todd's barbershop with its horrific sign of a wolf's head on a stake. The Americans joke, of course. They want somewhere to eat, to rest. It's hardly the Hilton, hardly inviting, hardly welcoming, much like the locals. They enter this Yorkshire pub, whose exterior, filmed in South Wales, gives way to the interior scene shot over 180 miles away in London. Laughter and the pub's ambience immediately halt as the lads enter. David Schofield, playing darts, hits a bullseye, and a dozen ambivalent eyes fall upon the American duo. They certainly stand out as the tourists that they are in their backpacks. David stands out like a sore thumb in his red padded coat, amidst all the tweed, wool, barber jackets and flat caps worn by the villagers. And what's that mark on the wall between the candles, positioned between the Yanks and the yokels? It's an ominous moment that makes you writhe in awkward discomfort. They feel they have to ask for permission to enter the supposed public house. The barmaid barely nods in agreement. It's not the first time, nor the last, that this awkward pub trope will be used in film or TV. In fact, it's not the last time that Landis used it either. I'm recalling Steve Martin, Chevy Chase and Martin Short, dressed in garish mariachi clothing, entering the dusty establishment of the Mexican town in The Three Amigos, another Landis-helmed comedy. The unsavoury gringos, all looking perplexed as these three song and dance men enter the pub. A very young Rick Mayall sits playing chess, as I mentioned earlier, 21 or 22 years old at the time. Landis had visited the Soho clubs in the weeks preceding the filming and watched Rick and his comedy partner Aid Edmondson performing in the Comedy Store. Their act, 20th Century Coyote, was energetic, anarchic, violent, an act that they carried through their careers for years. The Young Ones, the Dangerous Brothers, Filthy Rich and Catflap, Bottom. Rick would also bring his own half of that duo to Hollywood in the 90s comedy Drop Dead Fred, starring alongside Gremlins' Phoebe Cates. In Soho, Landis had enjoyed their act so much that he had invited them both to come and act as extras in the pub scene for his new movie. Rick turned up. Aid, however, didn't believe Landis, so he missed out. However, he would get his 5 minutes of Hollywood fame in 2017, though, when he surprised British audiences by turning up as Captain Peavy in Rian Johnson's controversial version of a Star Wars film, The Last Jedi. In the DVD commentary, actor David Norton explains that the pub's patrons were made up of West End actors, and Griffin Dunn says that they were half the cast of Nicholas Nickleby. He also says that as he had a lot more spare time to himself during the 10 or 11 week shooting schedule, that he would often go and watch these guys performing in their various plays at nights. Once the Yanks have seated, the barmaid approaches to take their order. Not something that a barmaid would have done in an English pub back then. You order at the bar, but the Americans wouldn't have known that, nor would the American who wrote the screenplay by any account, but we'll let him off. The tourist needs something hot. Any soup, any coffee, any hot chocolate. Three negative responses bat away each request. We serve spirits and beers, the barmaid explains. If it's something hot you want, you can have tea. A typical British hot drink. Still is. Landis got that right, at least. Oh, so you have tea? No, but I can make some if you like. Yes, please, they cheer in unison, and the mood seems to lighten a little. Jack is the first to notice the five-pointed star on the wall. They snigger as David suggests that maybe the owners are from Texas. As the barmaid arrives with her teas, Jack, ever the cheeky chappy, says, "Remember the Alamo?" The barmaid does. She saw it in London, in Leicester Square. Perplexed, Jack and David share a glance and a smirk. It's Brian Glover who explains that she means in the cinema. The John Wayne film. Oh, very bloody. Jack says, making conversation. Bloody awful, Glover retorts, to the amusement of the locals, which leads him nicely onto the joke about the crashing plane. He's obviously the joker of the pub. The regulars begin to jeer as he adjusts his seat to take centre stage, teasing them that they've missed their chance. He won't tell it. He knows, as well as they do, that he will tell it. As he tells the joke, Jack remains fixated on the pentagram, begging David to ask about it. Leave it, Jack. We are finally welcome in this stuffy little pub. The American shouts, remember the Alamar! Glover cheers the punchline, and chucks out the Mexican! The pub erupt in laughter, far too over the top for the actual joke itself. Rick Mayall spits beer everywhere. The stale atmosphere has finally dissolved, thank God. Until, that is, the young cocky American asks aloud, what's that sign on the wall for? Like a switch being flicked, the pub falls silent. Faces drop. The welcome, if ever there was one, is off the table. If it was awkward before, then this is just damn right painful. Schofield is not so lucky with his dart throwing this time. You made me miss. As the Americans rise to leave, the barmaid says, you can't let them go. She's the motherly type. Soft, caring, concerned. The men of the pub are not so much. As David and Jack are ejected back onto the moors, they are told to stick to the roads and beware the moon. And God be with you. Some dark secret that this community hold tight to their chests. Somehow, that star on the wall is the root of it. As the lads head out into the dark night, the thunder rolling in the distance, that knot in my 11-year-old stomach is now tighter than ever. Something evil this way comes, and I know it. I hold my breath, leaning ever closer to the TV, praying that my parents will not come in. Not yet. I just want to see what's about to happen. At least I thought I did. The banter between the two continues. They're obviously confused by what has just happened. David, probably a little disappointed too. They make light of their situation. The conversation continues in the pub after the lads are shown the door. It's murder then. They'll think us mad. As Jack and David veer from the road, the moors of this time have been filmed on the grounds of Windsor Castle. As the rain kicks in, David needs no reminder from Jack of how pleasant the weather is in Rome right now. Jack bursts into song, Santa Lucia, as David ad-libs a line, it's a cold and a wet out here. We nervously laugh along with them. Critics leapt on the movie at the time of its release, criticising it for not knowing what it wanted to be, whether it wanted to be a comedy or a horror. But now we look back and we realise just how effective this meld of comedy and horror is. It misleads us into a false sense of security as we laugh along with these two youngsters. Surely nothing untoward could ever happen to them. Landis really did start a trend. Horror and comedy have gone hand in hand forevermore. Maybe they'll be safe in the rain, the barmaid suggests. That's just before we hear the howl for the first time. It's in the distance, but clear enough for the barmaid to hear it. Her plea to go to them falls on deaf ears. Brian Glover heard nothing, nor the dart player, although their guilty, shifty eyes suggest otherwise. The lads on the moor hear it too, although it's closer to them. It stops them in their tracks. My 11-year-old heart starts to race. My mouth is dry. I try to swallow, but it's a dry gulp. The boys speculate, was that a coyote? In England? The Hound of the Baskervilles? Wrong moor, lads. That's Dartmoor. Just so happens to be my local stomping ground. Pecos Bill, then. Heathcliff? Heathcliff didn't howl, but he was on the moors. Still laughing in the face of absolute terror. That's what made this film unique at the time. Or one of the many things. Only then do they notice the full moon and the fact that they have failed to heed the advice of the locals by sticking to the road. That particular realisation is again accentuated by another howl. Unlike other movie werewolf howls before it, this howl uses 9 different noises to create the one. Landis claims that they used a panther, a wolf, a lion, and even a locomotive. However they did it, it is one of the most blood-curdling sounds in cinema. The fear factor certainly ramps up another notch or 8, as they decide now to head back to the safety of the slaughtered lamb. But it's too late. They are lost, and whatever beast is out there is now circling them. We hear it, but we don't see it. That's the ticket to the success of this scene, Norton explains in the commentary. Don't show it. Landis probably learnt that trick from his mate Spielberg, you know, the one who made my other favourite Universal monster movie about the giant man-eating fish, although he didn't show the shark much due to the fact that the damn thing wouldn't work. It just so happened that it made the movie far more chilling than the now legendary director could have hoped. Landis and Spielberg were friends, by the way. They both worked together on the ill-fated Twilight Zone, but even before that, Landis even gave a beardless, fresh-faced Spielberg a cameo in the final scenes of The Blues Brothers. The camera follows our two American friends as they nervously pace the moors, plumes of hot air exhaling from their mouths in the moonlight. As the camera circles in front of them both, they stop and look almost directly at us. We, for this moment, are positioned so that the wolf is behind us. They really do look petrified as David orders his friend to walk in another direction, and as their walk increases to almost a run, David falls off screen. Jack screams. My heart leaps into my mouth with this jump scare. But he's alright. David slipped, that was all. You really scared me, you shithead, Jack exclaims. And he's speaking for all of us. Laughing, David asks his friend to help him up. And I catch my breath as Jack leans in to help his friend. Without warning, from off screen left, the head of a large, razor-mouthed wolf lunges into Jack's side, accompanied by its horrendous roar. This scare upon scare works well, and Landis will use it one more time before the movie is out. Jack screams in agony as David up and legs it. The camera flicks from a close-up of Jack being savaged by an obscured, frantic head and lashing teeth of the beast, to shots of David escaping on foot. Each time we return to Jack, the beast still tears and rips at him. Jack's body more bloody than the last time, his screaming relentless. I was absolutely transfixed. A new kind of terror, never felt before, shook me to my core. I've been scared by film before. The trailers for the newest Nightmare on Elm Street movie, which played at the start of the Police Academy 3 video we used to rent all the time, used to scare the crap out of me. Freddy Krueger stalking teenagers, all scarred up with razors for fingers. However, it was later in this same year that I finally watched a full Nightmare on Elm Street movie, and it made me laugh. It was ridiculous to me, forever destroying the fear that I had felt when watching the trailers. Again, my young mind speculating on the unseen of what this pizza-faced killer in the Trilby may have done was far more terrifying than the actual film. But as Jack was torn to bits there in front of me on the Yorkshire moors, while I was not prepared for that. There's a realism to it, the lack of score over the action perhaps, as well as the performances from these two unknown young actors, and the darkness shrouding the monster from us, all culminated to create this really intense, frightening atmosphere. I shook all over as David turned back, the guilt of running away from his friend in need finally catching up with him. He had to help. He had to help. But as he arrives back at the steaming, mangled mess that used to be his friend, it soon becomes apparent that there is no helping him. And then it's his turn. The beast lunges into shot again, grounding David. Quick shots of the beast, its teeth teasing us but holding back from the full reveal. And then help arrives. The locals, armed with shotguns, the barmaid must have got the better of them, as they shoot and down the wolf. In a moment of silence, David, semi-conscious on the floor, looks to his side and sees the contorted, naked body of a man, white and pale in the moonlight. A shot that confused me as a child. Was that Jack? I didn't understand it. Obviously now I realise, of course, it's the naked body of the werewolf, one of the villagers' own, killed by their own hand due to the unfortunate arrival of these two Americans. As the camera fades to black, I switched off the TV and stood momentarily in the dark room. Not for long, I didn't. I flicked the switch from my bedside light and leapt into bed, heart still racing. I was traumatised. I didn't sleep much that night, and my bedside light remained on for the next few weeks. This was my first encounter with this movie, and the reason that still to this day it remains one of my favourite horror movies ever. That fear, although frightening beyond comprehension at the time, has always resonated with me, and I've always hoped to have it replicated with other horror movies, but never ever have. My mum, surprise surprise, didn't think I should watch that film. Lucky for me though, my older brother also wanted to see it, but as he was out with his friends, she was ordered to leave it recording. She hid the tape from me. Unfortunately for her, I knew her hiding place, and so, despite my complete terror, in the next week, as she left me at home while she worked at our local hardware shop, I dug it out. Perhaps in the daylight, with my friends at my side, the film wouldn't seem quite so scary. I had to see the rest of it. To be continued. Well, there you go. That, I don't know how to describe it really. It's just something I started writing and it just sort of escalated from there. So yeah, I will continue writing that. I don't know when. It could be next week. It could be in 6 months. But I thought this might make an interesting episode of the podcast. If you did enjoy this, please, please let me know. I'd love to hear your feedback from you. You can message us on Facebook, over on Instagram, or email us at wnmovietalk@gmail.com. Whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on, please go over, give us a 5-star rating, leave us a review, and that'd be absolutely great. But until next time, I am Trev, signing out. Chase!